Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a new low for Donald Trump, who in effect called the widow of the slain Green Beret killed in Niger a liar, following her remarks on ABC's Good Morning America, where she supported what Congresswoman Wilson had said about Trump's botched condolence call, saying Trump, quote, made me cry because I was very angry at the tone of his voice and how he said it. He couldn't remember my husband's name. A highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, and 2 Purple Hearts, Philip Butler, who was shot down over North Vietnam and spent 8 years as a POW, joins us. Now that we are in day 8 of the continuing scandal over Trump's handling of Gold Star families, we will discuss the national wound Trump opened when he accused his predecessors of not making condolence calls to the fallen, and the escalating war of words between Trump and Senator McCain. Having known McCain since they graduated together from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1961, and later as Phil Butler spent 8 years in captivity compared to McCain's 5, which Trump disparaged during the campaign, we will assess how Trump will react to being called a draft dodger, which was clearly implied in McCain's remark that rich kids avoided the Vietnam War by claiming to have bone spurs. Then we'll look into Niger, the country suddenly in the news, and the growing questions surrounding the U.S. military mission there and the apparent failure of intelligence that led to the ambush of 4 Green Berets, whose deaths have led to frictions between our military and civilian authorities and between Trump and the family of one of the fallen. Laura See, a professor of government at Colby College, who studies African politics, conflict, and development with a focus on Central Africa, joins us to discuss the activities of AFRICOM and Senator Lindsey Graham's announcement that there will be more U.S. aggression on the continent. Then finally, we will speak with John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, whose latest article at Foreign Policy and Focus is Trump's Enablers Should Be Shamed Out of Public Life. He joins us to discuss how the generals, the so-called adults in the room, are in fact enabling militaristic policies around the world and are only restraining Trump's personality defects and impulses, not his policies. And joining us now is Philip Butler, who's a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And he completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and today is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Butler.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be back.
Well, thanks, Phil. And can you believe that we're in day 8 of this scandal between Donald Trump and a congresswoman and the widow of a fallen Green Beret who was killed in Niger? And it's extraordinary to think that it's still going on. And today, Monday, on Good Morning America on ABC, the widow of the slain Sergeant David Johnson, first time in public she spoke. She confirmed what Congresswoman Wilson had said about what Trump had said in the car on the limo going to pick up the body, that her husband knew what he was getting into, and it made me cry, just quoting her, because it made me cry because I was very angry at the tone of his voice and how he said it. He couldn't remember my husband's name. Now, today, Donald Trump almost immediately tweeted back, I had a very respectful conversation with the widow of Sergeant David Johnson and spoke his name from beginning without hesitation. So, you know, what we're down to here, Phil, is that the President of the United States is calling the widow of a slain Green Beret a liar.
You know, Ian, I know this is the subject we want to talk about today, but I have to preface it with one thing, and that is that in my opinion, this entire 8-day-long travesty that you're talking about here is really nothing more than a distraction. It's a distraction from the really, really important stuff that's going on, leading off with North Korea. The Japanese have just announced that they think that the North Koreans have escalated to the point where it's ext- extremely dangerous. They're calling it extreme. And we've got ISIS people escaping from Iraq and heading out into Africa and parts unknown all around the world. And we've got all sorts of cyber warfare issues that we're vulnerable to that I hope somebody's paying attention to, but certainly not the press or the public. And then we've got this crazy so-called tax thing that's just a cut for rich people that's going to go on, that's going to put us another $4, 5, or 6 trillion in debt. So you can see my thinking that this is distraction. And having said that, now back to the distraction.
Let me interject, if I may. I have said a number of times, and I honestly believe that Donald Trump, that this is a conscious strategy on his part.
I totally agree. I think it's intentional.
The politics of distraction, and this is what I call government by stunt. You have a president who doesn't have a clue about what he's doing, is completely temperamentally unsuited for the job, and is completely ignorant of what's happening in the world and has no interest, is only interested in enriching his family and using his office to do so, which is really what's going on. But the fact that it's government by stunt is a way to distract us all from the fact that he's completely incompetent. And every day it's a stunt, and it's the only explanation for why he doubles down, particularly with this widow. Now, of course, he does have a problem with African Americans, and he doesn't. We don't have a scandal with the other three fallen white soldiers, do we?
No, I guess not. I mean, I don't know. I guess it's how this thing worked out. But he certainly went after the congresswoman. He obviously is very, very racist and very right wing, and he backs up the neo-Nazis by saying that they're equal to the people that were out demonstrating against the process that was going on. And so, but you're right. I love your title there, government by stunt. And I think it falls right in as a metaphor for what Senator Bob Corker said about Trump and what was going on in the White House. It's just actually a nutcase that's the White House, and unfortunately for us, it's at a very, very, very difficult and dangerous time for Americans and for our government and for our country.
Well, particularly when you consider that there's a rumor now that Trump has either decided or will decide to put the B-52, the bomber side of the triad, on full alert, which means that the B-52s and the B-1s, I guess, and the B-2s will be all sitting at the end of the runway, ready to be fired up and take off in an instant to bomb, well, who? I mean, obviously that's going to disturb the Russians, since they're the ones that would be most concerned about U.S.'s nuclear stance, but obviously
it'll just cause the Russians and the Chinese to do exactly the same thing. They have bombers they could put on full alert too, and that puts everybody's finger closer to the trigger. And I hate to see that, especially with the Russians, because they're just close to incompetence when it comes to this stuff. Anyway, I mean, it's nothing short, of course, of a miracle. I don't really believe in miracles, but if there ever were one, this would be a miracle that we didn't get into nuclear warfare with the Russians back during the Cold War. We came so very close several times that most people don't even know about it. Anyway, it's a very dangerous time for our nation on many different fronts, and then we have all of this, as you call it, government by stunt. I love that. That's a perfect title for it, and I do believe that it's intentional.
Again, I'm speaking with Philip Butler, a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. He completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and today is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. But it doesn't look as though this issue, as phony as it is perhaps, and cynically used by Donald Trump to distract us from his gross incompetence, nevertheless, it's going to go on. He's already picked a fight with your former POW colleague, John McCain, Senator McCain, who, as you recall, during the campaign, Donald Trump dismissed McCain in a very callous way. He said he's not a war hero. He was a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured. And that's probably...
I guess that included me.
Right, yeah. Exactly, yeah. It's all your fault.
People are forever asking me if I was a POW with John McCain, and of course my answer is no, I was not. John McCain was a POW with me.
Right.
I actually got there two and a half years before John did, but anyway, that's another story.
Right.
And I go back to the Naval Academy knowing each other back then, so we were even in the same company at the Naval Academy, oddly enough.
Well,
but, it's sad, though, that McCain is just now coming out with this because he knows that he will not, sadly, be serving another term as senator, and it seems that people have to be not up for re-election in our country before they can speak the truth to power, and it's really horrible. We've got all these Republicans in the Senate and in the House of Representatives, and they're all staying mum because they want to get this tax thing through before they say anything about this crazy president, even though they're not stupid. They know that he's practically leading us into nuclear war, but they'd rather take a chance on nuclear war than saying something against this guy for fear that their base might not reelect him. So what kind of courage is that? You send young kids out into combat to fight, like these 4 young soldiers that were killed in Niger, and they have the courage to go out and face the enemy, but these jerks that we elect in Congress don't have any guts at all. All they're worried about is their job. Imagine how they would be in a combat situation. I'd hate to have them in my unit. They'd be turning tail and running as fast as they could at the first sound of a gunfire.
Right, and frankly, they're there doing the bidding of the people who put them there, the donors, the Koch brothers. That's their real agenda. They're faithful servants of the plutocrats. But McCain, though, he's basically picked a fight, and Trump has said, I'm a nice guy. I'm not fighting back, but I will, and I'm known for it, and I'm ready to get ugly. Well, it looks like it's going to get uglier. McCain, the other day on The View, said that, apropos what we've been talking about so far, saying that we should not be fighting about a brave American who lost his life serving his country. That should not be a topic of discussion in America today. But just today on C-SPAN, he went further and talked about the Vietnam War and said how it was an obscenity that the rich kids didn't get sent and that the people who fought the war were the sons of the low-income Americans, and that the rich got out by getting a doctor to say that they had a bone spur. Well, we know that that's how Donald Trump had 5 college deferments and I believe 1 for a bone spur. Undeniably a dig at Trump. So do you expect this battle to escalate?
Oh, sure. I think it'll go just as long as Trump wants to keep it going, and I'm sure he wants to keep it going to distract people from the real problems and issues that are going on. This tiff back and forth between the congresswoman and Jim Kelly is a perfect example. You know, that's just been blasted out all over the news. That could go on for weeks and even months if the administration would keep fueling the fire and keep it going.
Well, it looks like the White House set Kelly up. I don't think he wanted to talk about his son. I think that's a deeply private wound, and that Trump sort of forced him into it. And then they obviously gave Kelly the wrong talking points at the White House. He went off and ad hominem attack on the congresswoman that turned out to be completely inaccurate. And now I don't know that he wants to speak up, but he has opened a kind of wound, whether intentionally or not, where he's talked about the difference between civilians and military people in this country, and more or less suggesting that only the military are honorable people. I find that a little nervous making, not so much in terms of a military coup, but in the general notion that, you know, we spend so much on defense today that, you know, the military, I mean, admittedly, most of it doesn't go to the men and women in service, it goes to the contractors. But on the other, you know, still they're getting pretty much a lion's share of the treasure, spending more today on defense than we did at the height of the Cold War. It's obviously less of a percentage of our GDP since our GDP has gone up, but still it's an extraordinarily, they are in a very privileged position, the military, in terms of our resources. We don't fill potholes, but we buy the latest jets, etc. What's your response to that?
Oh, that's absolutely true. I think that this country would be much better off with a much smaller military, and we wouldn't be sending young kids into harm's way so much, into problems that are not ours to solve. I don't know what in the world we think we're doing in the Middle East now. We certainly don't need the oil anymore, so we can't send kids out to fight for oil. So why are we in there? Well, we're stuck, just like Lyndon Johnson said at the beginning of the Vietnam War. He said he didn't know how in the hell we could ever win this thing. We couldn't win it, but we couldn't get out. And he was losing sleep over it. Well, he lost sleep, and 58,000 American kids lost their lives, and two to four million Vietnamese people lost their lives because he couldn't screw up the courage to do what was right and get us out of that war. Just like presidents today can't get us out of all the wars that we're in that are just nonsense. You know, American boys and girls are not going to solve the problems of the Sunni and Shia fight that's been going on for 1,500 years. We're just not going to solve that one. I think probably Muslim and Arab boys and girls are going to have to solve that problem, and probably going to have to kill a lot of each other before they do finally come to terms and solve the problem. But here we are, you know, fighting in Iraq, and we don't even know whose side we're on. Are we on the side of the Kurds, or are we on the side in Syria, on the side of the Syrians? You know, it's just absolutely nuts. Eventually, the whole thing over there is probably going to wind up being Shiistan, Kurdistan, and Sunnistan. But before that happens, Americans are going to lose lots of lives and treasure, and I guess we're going to help keep it going over there. So in my opinion, if we had a smaller military and a smaller budget for the military by something like half, then we probably wouldn't be so inclined to get into all these idiotic wars, other people's trying to solve other people's problems.
Well, I think the thing that offended most people, I mean, as I mentioned, Kelly, particularly when he left the press conference that he held to get Trump off the hook, where he asked the press, is there anyone here a Gold Star parent or sibling? Does anyone here know a Gold Star parent or sibling? Asking the press that, the implication was pretty clear that somehow the civilians aren't sufficiently respectful of military sacrifice. But in defending General Kelly, the White House press secretary said it's highly inappropriate to question a four-star Marine general. That has, I think, even upset people more. Even General Petraeus came out against that statement. What's your reaction to what?
Well, that was a nutty sidetrack from the whole argument. That was really a stupid thing for her to say, because that four-star Marine general works for us. You know, he works for us. We don't work for him. That's the way the nation is supposed to operate. On the other hand, you know, I can see Jim Kelly as just a person, as a human being, as a man who was a military man all of his life, and he lost his son. He must be enormously proud of his son, who was also a Marine officer, and he lost him in combat in Afghanistan, and that must be just beyond painful for the man. So I think, you know, in a sense, I have to give Jim Kelly a pass as just as a person, as a man, for running off the mouth, probably in the wrong direction. I mean, who among us hasn't been wounded emotionally to the point where we said things that weren't absolutely correct or were nonsense or were not, you know, up to our normal, let's say, critical thinking? So I give Kelly a pass for that, but I don't give the president and the administration and all these people a pass for all of these continuing silly distractions when all of the important things that are going on are being pasted over.
Yeah, but it was Trump who dragged General Kelly into the gutter, and he's again dragging us all into the gutter by basically calling the widow of the slain Green Beret in Niger a liar. So I'd put it all on Trump.
I do too, and I think it's a horrible thing. I can't imagine anybody saying something like that to that woman. I know that when I was towards the end of my naval service as a Navy commander, I was invited to come over to Salinas, which is near Monterey, to give Purple Hearts out to Gold Star mothers who had lost their sons in the Bataan Death March. There was a tank company that came from Salinas that was in Bataan, and so many Salinas sons were lost, and some survived the death march, and some became prisoners of war in Japan. But there were about a dozen of these mothers that I awarded Purple Hearts to in this little ceremony over there, and I had fortunately looked through the list before I awarded these out, and I noticed that one woman was a little bit different from the others, and I saved her as last, and I called her up and announced that I was giving her two Purple Hearts because she had lost two sons and had Bataan, not one but two. And I got to tell you that there was not a dry eye in the house when that was announced. So yes, I think anybody who doesn't have it in their hearts to have just incredible sympathy and, you know, and empathy for a mother or a father who loses a son or a daughter in those circumstances, or for that matter, any circumstances, I guess there can't be anything worse than losing a son or a daughter. You know, we're supposed to outlive our children, but it's very sad when we don't.
Well, Philip Butler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It's always a pleasure to be on your Pacifica station.
Well, thank you again, Philip. And again, I've been speaking with Philip Butler, who's a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And he completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And today is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Niger, the country suddenly in the news.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Yes, war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Gonna lay down my hymn. Down by the riverside, down by the riverside.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Laura See, who's a professor of government at Colby College. She studies African politics, conflict, and development with a focus on Central Africa, and has also written for Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, Guernica, and Al Jazeera English. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laura See.
Thanks for having me.
And the controversy over the deaths of the special forces operators in Niger continues to burgeon with a back and forth between President Trump and what he calls the wacky Congresswoman, Representative Frederica Wilson. Now she's charging Donald Trump, saying that Niger is Trump's Benghazi and he needs to own it. Is there any sense from what you've studied so far about the U.S. involvement in Niger that would suggest any kind of cover-up?
Nothing that I'm aware of. I mean, I do think that there are significant questions surrounding what happened, particularly on the day of the attack and in the moments after. And as you know, the search for Sergeant Johnson's body took about 48 hours. I think those are real and important questions. But I also think there are investigations going on, and that we, you know, it's hard to say that there's a cover-up when no one has said anything in any direction about giving answers, right? So we just don't know what happened. We only have some sparse details about the events of that day, and we're waiting to get some answers. Now, certainly, I think, you know, Mrs. Johnson deserves answers more than anyone, and I hope that she will get those answers. And certainly the president has bungled the response to this and his treatment of her, to put it as nicely as I can. And there's absolutely no excuse for that. But I don't have any reason to believe that there's a cover-up, just as I don't have any reason to believe there was a cover-up in Benghazi.
Well, that's not to say, though, that some members of Congress, including prominent Republicans, are not frustrated with the Trump administration. Senator James Lankford, a Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee, has on Sunday on Face the Nation said that they want a full, accurate story. And we have all the same questions that have already been mentioned. And we want to find out what actually happened. And that's the key aspect right now, is all the facts that are on the ground. Senator McCain, of course, has expressed frustration over the lack of details. How would you rank this government in terms of its cooperating with the Congress and other branch of government in terms of letting our lawmakers know exactly what's going on in this foreign policy arena, where, you know, clearly there's a great deal of surprise, I think, amongst most Americans who probably didn't even know the U.S. was involved in Niger?
Yes, I think the shock of just a tragic situation has been compounded by the fact that people were totally surprised by the fact that we have forces there and that they are actively involved in very dangerous situations. And I would say that the fact that Congress is surprised, and the fact that Congress, you know, you have members of Congress openly complaining that they aren't being kept well informed, is a sign of what a low priority this administration has put on Africa policy. The fact that we do not have key political appointees. There is no Assistant Secretary of State for Africa who's been appointed. There is no Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Africa. And the folks at the NSC, who are very capable and good at their jobs, but they're sort of much more junior level than what you would have if the administration had appointed people to take these positions and run the lead and do things like interface with Congress and provide them with information when events happen. And so, you know, if there's negligence anywhere, I think that's the key point of negligence, just that they haven't even bothered to staff up and to put personnel into place to provide information. And because of that, they are facing, you know, rightful frustration and anger, I think, from members of Congress. But I would also add, you know, this is not a new thing. These troops are not troops that Trump deployed. This has been going on for a long time. The expansion of U.S. presence in Africa started under the George W. Bush administration, and it greatly expanded under Obama, including the deployment of forces to Niger that started in 2012. And if members of Congress were not aware that so many forces were there, that's their fault. That's them being negligent in their duties of oversight and their responsibility to know what's going on in the global war on terror. And the fact that, you know, you have members of Congress, members of the president's party even coming out and saying that they weren't aware of any of this, I think speaks to how murky the waters are around exactly what the global war on terror is supposed to be about, what its boundaries are and are not, and about the mission creep that's been going on for the last 15 years.
Well, there's even a bit of a tiff going on between Republican senators. Lindsey Graham who apparently was present at the March hearing where the head of AFRICOM mentioned that U.S. troops were in Niger, and he expressed surprise, of course, and Senator Rand Paul struck back at him by saying, you know, you're in too many wars in too many places when even warmonger Lindsey Graham can't keep track anymore. That's pretty stern stuff, isn't it?
It is, and I find it difficult, you know, with my political persuasion, I find it difficult to believe that I agree with Rand Paul, but I think I do, at least on that little sound bit. It's a lot, and I this is different from the engagement in Afghanistan or the engagement in Iraq. It is not full-scale involvement in a war, but it is a presence of American military forces on the ground in very dangerous places, and this is not just going on in Niger. I think the American people would be shocked if they knew how many places across the continent American forces are and have been deployed over the course of the last decade or so, and the types of danger that they are in. And this is a long overdue conversation about just what it is we're doing, not just in Africa, but in other parts of the world. How significant or tangential are these conflicts to the direct foreign policy interests of the United States, and whether being involved in these conflicts is worth the cost of lives.
And again, I'm speaking with Laura See, who is a professor of government at Colby College. She studies African politics, conflict and development, with a focus on Central Africa. And she's also written for Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, Guernica and Al Jazeera English. Well, as what we've known from AFRICOM's briefings is that the U.S. has about between 6,000 and 7,000 troops in Africa on any given day, according to Robin Mack, the spokesman for AFRICOM, and that they're in countries such as Chad, Somalia, Libya, and Cameroon. They have a big base in Djibouti, which is largely preoccupied with the war in Yemen, as far as I know.
Right. But
they're also building a major drone base in Agadez in central Niger. And I believe that is one of the criticisms so far, not that the details are in on what happened to those special forces soldiers that were ambushed. But what I've heard so far is that they didn't have drone coverage. They had to rely on the French, who came in about 20 minutes late, and that had they had drone coverage, they may not have been ambushed. And that drone coverage was vetoed by the U.S. ambassador in Niger. So what do you know about those details?
So I don't know anything about that. I saw that report earlier today. I think it was John Nagel who was commenting, and the report that I read said something about the U.S. ambassador in Tunisia having vetoed the use of those drones, which didn't make any sense to me why the ambassador in Tunisia would have veto power over something going on in Niger. But that's largely outside the scope of my knowledge. I mean, we do know that the drone base is under construction. We do know that part of the reason I think that the United States is so willing to partner with the Nigerians is that we do have an interest in getting that base built and being able to use it for regional operations. But as far as whether having drone coverage that day would have happened and second of all would have made a difference, I don't know that you can say that. I mean, one thing that seems very clear from this is that whoever had to estimate the risk and decide what the risk of being in this particular community, meeting with the local elders and community leaders on that day, they thought it was a low-risk occasion. They didn't bring their heavy armored vehicles. They didn't bring a lot of backup. They clearly saw it as sort of a community engagement opportunity and not a risky situation. And obviously that was a miscalculation, but I would have to think if you're not bringing this stuff to immediately protect yourself, it's hard to see why they would have brought in drones in that situation as well. And as far as the French military, I mean, I think it's important for folks to understand just what a huge area we're dealing with. I think it's pretty remarkable that the French were there within 20 or 30 minutes. I haven't seen any information about where they had to come from to get there, but the fact that they were able to provide air support very, very rapidly in an incredibly remote place, I think is actually a pretty, I've never found myself saying this before, but like a positive positive attribute of the French military, and shows what they're capable of doing in West Africa.
So what do we know about the government of Niger? What kind of a government is there?
Niger's government is fairly weak in terms of its capacity. It is an old, it was a French colony and has faced a lot of the challenges of neocolonial rule that other French former French colonies have faced. It went through long periods of military rule, sort of a lot of coup d'etat happening. So one group overthrowing another, overthrowing another, overthrowing another. I believe they're on their seventh republic at the moment. So they've been through a lot in just over, under 60 years of history. But it has been largely stable since 2010. They did have presidential elections after the last coup, which was also in 2010, and haven't had a successful coup attempt since. So it certainly things have been getting better there on the sort of on a relative scale, I guess we would say, in terms of political management. But the country is still very, very weak. It's a vast territory, large proportion, most of it is desert, so very dry, only a few agricultural regions. They have very low capacity. So when they face a crisis, like, for example, from time to time, the Niger River floods, and this generally kills a lot of people, causes mudslides, all kinds of terrible things. And the government has very, very limited capacity to respond to that. There have been disease outbreaks in recent years that, again, have required significant help from the international community in order to address. So we're talking about a government with limited capacity, in a very difficult environment, and a very limited ability, like I said, to protect civilians.
And I would imagine, given the nature of the coups, that whatever government's in power in Niger, the military largely there is the Praetorian Guard to protect the leader, right?
Well, I don't know if you could say that at this point, but certainly that has been a pattern in the past. But yeah, I think today it's that's an open question, let's put it that way.
Well, the last time Niger hit the headlines was back in the George W. Bush administration when Vice President Cheney and his chief of staff were involved in outing a CIA officer over the fact that her husband, a former U.S. ambassador to Niger, had disputed a charge that the Bush administration had put forth that Saddam Hussein was buying uranium from Niger. So what is the situation vis-a-vis uranium? Is that their main export?
So Niger does have the famous yellow cake uranium. That's one export, but they're increasingly in the oil economy. So right now, oil is a fairly limited. It's something like the last thing I saw was about 20,000 barrels a day capacity. But that's changing rapidly, and there's a belief that there's a much larger reserve of oil, and they're trying to move it so that they can export it out through. There's a pipeline that runs from Chad to Cameroon down to the coast of the Atlantic, and they'll be exporting it that way. So oil is becoming more important. There is an agricultural economy as well, but most Nigerians don't benefit in any kind of significant way from either mining interest. And I should mention there's also gold, but they don't really benefit from mining interest or from the oil industry. Or from uranium. Most people are very poor, struggling to survive however they can, whether that's through subsistence farming or living in cities and trying to earn money however they can.
And is it is largely, even though it's a French colony, is it still largely Islamic? Or?
Yes, it's almost entirely Islamic.
Right. So, well, just in the last minute or so then, Laura C., Lindsey Graham on the Senate Armed Services Committee said, quote, "The war is morphing. You're going to see more actions in Africa, not less. You're going to see more aggression by the U.S. towards our enemies, not less. You're going to have decisions being made not in the White House, but out in the field." Now, what kind of a harbinger is that, do you think?
Well, I can't say that I'm surprised. Under a Trump administration, the idea that they would want to expand the fight against Islamic extremist terrorism is not particularly surprising, but I do think that there is need for a debate over the wisdom of that course of action, for example, so this group that attacked the American and Nigerian soldiers and killed 9 people a couple weeks ago, what is the interest of the United States versus the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara? This is not an organization that has great capacity. They are opportunists. They took advantage of a point of vulnerability. They attacked on motorbikes and in pickup trucks. It was not any kind of sophisticated attack using sophisticated weaponry. And this is something that happened in a very isolated place. They don't have the capacity to attack the United States homeland. You know, it's not even actually clear that they have the capacity to attack American interests in the region, like our embassies or hotels and restaurants and that kind of thing where American expatriates spend time in Niger and Mali or other parts of the region. And I think that, you know, the more we escalate these conflicts, as we've seen in other parts of the world, that can tend to backfire in that it actually radicalizes more young people and causes more people to join these movements and can lead to these kind of endless and murkily defined wars. So I would say that, you know, I don't know that there's a right answer here. Certainly, the U.S. does some good in this region. The militant groups terrorize the local population. And if the United States and other partner militaries are able to help protect those populations and help people not to suffer so much, that is a good thing. But to what extent it's in the United States' interest to expand that, and what potential enemies and problem situations it could create are big open questions, and we ought to be having a discussion about that instead of trying to score political points off a tragedy.
Well, I'm about to score a political point by closing and asking, do you think that President Trump is going to be boning up on Africa? After all, he met with a group of African leaders the other day and referred to a mythical country of Nambia.
Yes, Nambia. I don't think so. I will say that in every administration, Africa is a low priority. It doesn't matter if it's Democrats or Republicans, but I think that with the Trump administration, this is a particularly low priority, and that may ultimately not be a bad thing for the Africans. If attention turns away to something else and they just kind of leave the status quo, that might be the best possible outcome.
Well, Laura C., I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Laura C., who's a professor of government at Colby College. She studies African politics, conflict and development with a focus on Central Africa. And she's also written for Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, Guernica and Al Jazeera English. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing how the generals, the so-called adults in the rooms, are in fact enabling militaristic policies around the world and are only restraining Trump's personality defects and impulses, not his policies.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs.
I just don't want. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Pfeffer, who is the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously, he worked as an associate editor of the World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. His books include Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy After September 11 and Crusade 2.0. And his latest article at Foreign Policy and Focus is Trump's Enablers Should Be Shamed Out of Public Life. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Pfeffer.
Thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, thank you, John. And if you are calling for Trump's enablers to be shamed out of public life, that's almost the entire U.S. Senate and U.S. Congress, at least on the Republican side, I should say. They're all putting up with his disgraceful antics simply to get their tax cuts and whatever the Koch brothers and Mercer and these billionaires tell them that they want. Isn't that what's going on?
Unfortunately, you're right. It's unquestionably true that Congress, or at least the Republicans, have been Trump's enablers, although they haven't enabled much, to be honest, from the congressional side. I mean, a lot of Trump's intended legislation, whether it's the repeal of health care or immigration, has not been pushed through by the Republicans, forcing the president to issue executive orders. But nevertheless, the Republicans have otherwise provided cover for the president. I was mostly interested, though, in my article in looking at this concept of the so-called adults in the room. And that means the people inside the administration, the putative adult supervision that is supposed to be preventing Donald Trump from, you know, engaging in the worst excesses. And so that, of course, would be his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, the head of the Pentagon, Jim Mattis, National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, and John Kelly, previously of the Homeland Security, but now his Chief of Staff. These are supposed to be his handlers, his whisperers, etc. And in my article, what I wanted to show was, in fact, these enablers, these people who are supposed to be the adults in the room, are in fact responsible for the worst excesses. In fact, even worse than what Congress or the congressional Republicans have been up to, because, of course, the congressional Republicans have been largely inept. His enablers within the administration, on the other hand, have basically taken what passes for ideas in Donald Trump's head and makes them into some form of reality. To give you one example, Rex Tillerson over at the State Department, despite his reputation for being the more diplomatic of the people inside the administration, has taken a knife to the State Department, has been involved in what he calls, rather euphemistically, reorganization.
So you mention in your article at Foreign Policy in Focus, Trump's enablers should be shamed out of public life. The recent article cover of the New York Review of Books by James Mann that traces the origin of the phrase adults in the room in terms of Washington parlance. Walk us through that.
Sure. So Mann's article is very interesting. In looking at a particular shift that has taken place in the language, particularly here in Washington. So the phrase adults in the room or adult supervision previously applied to kind of ideological limits. In other words, here in Washington, certain ideas are considered to be part of the mainstream, whereas other ideas fall outside the pale. And the adults in the room or the adult supervision are basically the people who know what the acceptable parameters of discussion are, ideologically speaking, and patrol those borders very carefully. And so when someone goes outside of these borders, the adults rein them back in, say, no, well, that's not really acceptable. And as Mann points out, you know, there are some people who are just never part of this mainstream conversation, who are never really considered to be adults, people like Bernie Sanders or Rand Paul. These are people whose ideological points of view place them outside of the room, essentially.
Right, but it's now, but isn't it also a very underhand way of dismissing people that have valid but different ideas as more or less saying, well, they're on the fringes, they're crackpots?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's a way of infantilizing them. I mean, obviously, if they're not adults, they are not they're not worthy of participating in the conversation. They should be at the kids' table. They should be quiet unless talking to, et cetera. All the kind of connotations we associate with kind of the split between an adult and a child. But what happens in the current era, of course, is that the phrase adult supervision changes. It is now used in mainstream discourse and mainstream media largely to apply to behavioral limits rather than ideological limits. In other words, it's almost taken for granted that the kind of mainstream of politics has shifted so far to the right that the phrase adults in the room refers to those people in the Trump administration who are there to restrain his behavior, not to restrain his ideology. In some sense, Trump doesn't really have an ideology, or at least he doesn't have a coherent ideology. So people like Rex Tillerson, James Mattis, they're there to prevent Donald Trump from following his instincts, if you will, to kind of be the superego to his id, to prevent him from launching nuclear weapons left and right to prevent him from tweeting national security secrets to the entire world. However it's represented, they are there for behavioral reasons. So this is the interesting kind of transformation that Mann talks about.
So the idea is, though, that we should take comfort after that these people are around. And I think that in itself is fairly pernicious. And what you're talking about is that we shouldn't really take any comfort, because while they may be restraining Trump's more outrageous behavior personally, they are going along with his policies. Now, recently, of course, they did seem to have forced a compromise, at least a little, from Trump's outrageous demands about wanting to destroy Obamacare. There's a vague compromise there, although he's pretty much stabbed it in the back. And over the Iran deal, there's an alleged compromise. He wanted to tear it up altogether, but they kind of convinced him to punt it to the Congress. So is that would that go along with your analysis?
It does. Although, you know, the question really is whether we're dealing with a kind of a strategy. In other words, Trump kind of leads with the most outrageous demands, which, you know, either he and his administration together believe is just the opening bid, and then recognizing that the opening bid is going to be rejected, as if it were, for instance, a real estate deal, the adults come in and say, okay, well, he was just speaking kind of metaphorically, or he was speaking, it was a joke, or that's not exactly how you should interpret what he said. This is really what we want to do, and come back with this kind of, as you say, compromise language on the Iran nuclear deal, on healthcare. But I think it's both more complicated and less complicated than that. Less complicated in the sense that I don't think there's a strategy. I don't think that his advisors and Trump sit down and kind of plan out tactically how they're going to get something through. I think Trump just goes ahead and says what's on his mind, goes with his gut, so to speak, and then his advisors or the so-called adults have to scramble to kind of salvage something from this policy direction. So that's the less complicated thing. And the more complicated thing is that I think that ultimately, at least from the point of view of the so-called adults, they have the same kind of end game in mind. In other words, let's say with the Iran nuclear deal, they recognize that that it would look bad for the United States to pull out of the nuclear agreement. They want the nuclear agreement to fail. They just want it to fail a different way. They want it to fail with Iran pulling out because Iran is so disgusted or fed up or frustrated with U.S. conduct. They want, you know, healthcare they want Obamacare to fail, but they want it to fail in a way in which they can, you know, deny culpability for its failure. So I think, you know, that's a more complicated kind of aspect of so-called adult behavior. But from my point of view, you know, it is just as bad, or one could argue worse than Trump's behavior, or Trump's policy directions, because, you know, these people, these adults, so-called adults, are really the ones responsible for the tremendous militarism of U.S. foreign policy at the moment, the kind of unraveling of any kind of multilateral engagement the United States might have in the world, responsible for the kind of auto-destruction of the federal government, the unraveling of federal programs and the axing of agencies, unraveling of environmental regulations. These are the people who are actually enacting, implementing it on a daily basis. And so that's, for me, you know, why they are the ones that should be held responsible, and they should eventually have to pay some kind of price for it.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, there's, of course, a famous movie in the 1960s by John Frankenheimer, 7 Days in May, that was about a military coup against what was considered a kind of weak and dovish American president who wanted to appease the Soviet Union, and these red-blooded generals came in and had a coup. Now, some people have argued that what we have today in the White House is the opposite of a military coup. You actually have the military restraining a crazy civilian who is the President of the United States. I take it you're not entirely in agreement with that theory.
Well, you know, at one level, yes, of course. I mean, the restraint is at the lowest possible denominator, and that is prevention of nuclear war, okay? So, yes, it seems at least up to this point they've prevented him from, you know, raining fire and fury down on North Korea. But if we look at kind of military policy more generally, I don't see much restraint. I mean, certainly if we're talking about military spending, if we're talking about military exports to countries like Saudi Arabia, if we're talking about support for other countries' wars, like the Saudi war in Yemen, if we're talking about continuation of the longest war in U.S. history, the sending of additional troops to Afghanistan, aggravating of the horrors in Syria, the potential for greater conflict of a non-nuclear nature with North Korea, well, frankly, I don't see much restraint there. So I wouldn't let them off the hook by saying that they have had necessarily a positive influence. Now, again, like I said, if all we're talking about is nuclear war and preventing it, okay, sure, that's fine. I'm happy that they're there to prevent that from happening, but that's a pretty low bar.
Well, in closing then, what do you think is going to happen? We talked earlier in the program about Trump's escalation of the battle with the widow and how at the new low, where he's basically calling the widow of a slain Green Beret a liar, and John McCain is now entering the fray, calling him a draft dodger, in effect implying that he a rich kid that avoided the Vietnam War over a bone spur, which was certainly the case. Where do you think we're heading in terms of civilian-military relations in this country?
Well, I think this goes back to the initial point, and that is kind of the role of Congress and the role of Republicans in Congress. And this is why I hesitate to throw all Republicans in Congress into this category of enablers, even though I would agree that they are. But I do think that tactically speaking, we're going to see people like John McCain, people like Bob Corker, senator from Tennessee, pull away from Trump and pull away from the administration. They will be forced to, because it will simply become unacceptable from the point of view of their constituencies, from the point of view of their own morality, from the point of view of the preservation of the Republican Party to align themselves with the president. And that ultimately is going to be the deciding factor. It might not be the deciding factor, after the next elections, if the Democrats do not, retake Congress. But it will be a deciding factor at some point. And then, there'll be a much thicker line between those who continue to support Donald Trump and implement his policies and those increasingly within his own party, not speaking of the opposition, those within his own party who have abandoned him and have taken a more principled stand.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, John Pfeffer.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And again, I've been speaking with John Pfeffer, who's the co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he has an article, Trump's Enablers Should Be Shamed Out of Public Life. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for full podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.